Good afternoon, and welcome to the April meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. I'm Tom DeMarco, sitting in for our president, Mac DeFord, who will be back next month. The forum is now celebrating its, or entering into its 31st year. This is meeting number 381 of the Midcoast Forum, bringing you each month presentations by significant figures in diplomacy, in journalism, talking about foreign relations and often our lack thereof. More details on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, the topic is going to be Africa, where suddenly there are more than a million Chinese in presence, Chinese nationals there doing projects and involved in African affairs in a way that it has got to be somewhat troubling. And here to tell us how to make sense of that is Swithin Munyantwali. Swithin is a Ugandan national based in Kampala. He is a principal, actually the executive director, of the and co-founder of the International Law Institute African Center for Legal Excellence. And in his work, he is our man on the ground all over sub-Saharan Africa, and therefore in a good position to tell us about what the sudden Chinese presence there means. As we learned last night at dinner, his main work is in a slightly different field, and I hope, Swithin, you'll find some time to tell us about that. That is his work as part of the African Center for Legal Excellence. There's a brochure on your tables. And this is an attempt to combat corruption with a robust system of rule by law. Corruption is Africa's dragon, Swithin is Africa's St. George. And I hope you'll find some time at the end of your presentation to tell us about the African Center for Legal Excellence and its program. We're delighted to have you, Swithin Munyantwali.
Thank you, Tom. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank the forum for the excellent hospitality that has been accorded to me since we began communicating several months ago, and a wonderful conversation that I had with members of the forum last night. It's a pleasure also to be here when the weather is so fantastic, since I was following the developments in this country over the last few months and praying that I could bring East African weather with me, which it seems we may have been lucky to do. I'm also very delighted to be here in the presence of the president of our institute, Chuck Vero, who has been a great mentor in the years that I've been doing this work, and we stand on shoulders of people like Chuck in the work that we do. I wouldn't call myself a China expert per se, as I mentioned yesterday, but I will say that because of the involvement of China in our region, you can't but help think about the impact of that. So the following slides are a collection of thoughts that I've gathered from personal experience as well as research that I carried out prior to this presentation. I have carried out similar presentations in Hong Kong and Shenzhen. There is a historical relationship between Africa and China that I discovered goes back way before this current relationship existed. And according to historians and archaeologists, as you can see, experts believe this began 138 to 126 BC. Zheng He, who was an administrator and diplomat during the Ming Dynasty in the years that you see in Imperial China, arrived on the East African coast several years before Vasco da Gama. According to various researchers, the Yongle Emperor commissioned these expeditions because he was motivated by the real need for overseas products felt particularly at court, and desire to increase his own prestige and to reestablish the overseas renown of the Chinese Empire. During this early period, the Silk Road was established, which was an important route connecting Asia with the Middle East, Mediterranean world, including North Africa and Europe. We then, in the early 50s, begin an ideological era, which was primarily formed during the Cold War period. And in 1955, there was a Bandung Conference, which was a meeting between 29 Asian and African states focused on the promotion of economic and cultural relations between the two continents. Again, a common foundation back then was resisting Western domination under the five principles that you see there. And if I may read them for you, basically mutual respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity. And again, these themes will reoccur during my presentation. Mutual non-aggression and interference in each other's affairs, equality and mutual benefit, peaceful coexistence. Subsequently, China began to provide all kinds of support, economic, technical, military, in countries of the region. There was a formation of the Non-Aligned Movement, formally set up in 61, which was part of this process. In that picture, you see the founders of that movement, from left to right, Tito of Yugoslavia, Nehru of India, Nasser of Egypt, Nkrumah of Ghana, and Sukarno of Indonesia. And this was, again, all part of the fight for independence. And there were also strong relationships with freedom fighters, with others such as Julius Nyerere of Tanzania. In the 1970s, these relationships increased, resulting in the following: a number of African countries with diplomatic ties to China increasing. China joins the UN Security Council, which was welcomed by many African states due to the growing relationships that the region had with China. What you see in the picture there was the Tanzania-Zambia Railway Project, which was a turnkey project constructed in the 1970-75 period. So really the beginnings, the very early beginnings of infrastructure development in the sub-Saharan African region that we see so much of today. This is $500 million loan, interest-free loan from China. We ask ourselves even today whether they're really interest-free, but we'll discuss that later. Operations of the railway, which commenced, currently handle exports and imports in the mostly the SADC region, which is the Southern African Development Community, which is bottom part of the sub-Saharan African region. So Tanzania, Zambia, Malawi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Great Lakes, South Africa and Zimbabwe, still being served by this railway. China continued to support African nationalist movements during this period. And again, continuing to stress this dichotomy between the world's superpowers, haves and have-nots in that conversation. A big turning point was the Tiananmen Square, which took place shortly after I finished college, and was very well publicized all over the world. And this really marked a major shift from what I have gathered following fierce Western reaction to the events during that horrible day. An overall assessment of China's poor human rights record. Subsequent arms and other embargoes imposed by the Northern powers prompted China to seek closer ties to other non-Western countries. Subsequently, developing countries were elevated to the cornerstone of Chinese foreign policy in an effort to build a coalition against Western criticism. Again, due to the numerical weight of the African bloc at the UN, this was seen as a way to further develop the Chinese strategy that I've described. What is the current relationship between Africa and China? Commercial relations have taken center stage, and any visit to the continent will clearly demonstrate this. In a picture here, you see China's previous premier, Wang Jiabao, embracing a Ghanaian leader in Accra in 2006. And to the left there is Ghana's former president, John Kufuor. In January 2007, a Chinese firm won the contract to produce Ghana's 15th anniversary cloth after the government permitted international competitive bidding from the private sector, excluding the local industry. This is a theme that I will turn to during my presentation. China's currently Africa's largest trading partner, with a trade volume in excess of $200 billion annually. The US and Europe are second and third, respectively. Trade is actively promoted by our governments and encouraged by China's new market orientation policy. And there's an identification in China's transition from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy that it is today, simply because the region is so dependent on agriculture. And so there is a sense that what is it that we can learn from the Chinese in moving our economies forward. There's also a similar identification with previously underdeveloped countries such as the BRICS nations, so Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, which recently joined the BRICS. So that identification is also currently very much in the minds of many in the region. The Asian tigers do hold a similar appeal. During the non-aligned movement, many will tell you, and the research will show, that a number of countries, including Singapore, were at the same level of GDP growth to sub-Saharan Africa. And this has substantially changed since. So there is that identification also. The new investments by China in sub-Saharan Africa is also part of this hope and dream that our economies can make a similar transition. You hear a lot about Chinese interest in the extractives, so mining, oil and gas, and so on. But there is a lot of information that suggests, and we see certainly, that Africa is increasingly viewed as a place to do business beyond the extractives, so that if you look at the IMF and some research by The Economist, there is quite a bit of non-commodity investment, including a lot of small business, wholesale trading, retail, catering, and textiles. And as we all know, small and medium enterprises are the engine of growth in any economy. And so for the Chinese to be making incursions in this space is of particular significance and concern at the moment. But these are not uncommon pictures that you see in some of the trading centers around the region. A number of Chinese firms have used the African Growth and Opportunity Act, and Chuck, who's a trade expert, can speak more to AGOA and other multilateral arrangements than I can, but the preferential arrangements provided under the AGOA basically provide an opportunity for African firms to export to the United States. The Chinese in places like Lesotho and Kenya have actually used this opportunity to actually begin producing in the region for export to the United States, which again provides an opportunity for them to escape growing labor costs at home and develop a new trade route to this country. Chinese construction of local bridges, of local infrastructure, include bridges. $14 million bridge connecting, $140 million bridge connecting Zambia to the DRC. Offices, I have visited these offices of the African Union that you see there in Ethiopia, its capital Addis Ababa. This was a $200 million project for which China basically picked up the tab. Roads, Zambia's most expensive road being funded by Chinese investment and a proliferation of Chinese companies in our region. But not all is rosy in this relationship that began back when I, during the non-aligned movement. A number of issues of concern have been raised. Chinese labor, where there's unprecedented importation of Chinese labor to basically staff a number of the infrastructure projects on the continent. And last year it was reported that Zambia's Home Affairs Minister basically issued a strong rebuke to the Chinese ambassador when he had paid him a courtesy call about the repeated failure of Chinese firms to adhere to labor standards in Zambia. And in many cases, these violations have resulted in deadly labor disputes. This is being reported widely around the region and becoming a centerpiece of concern in engagement with the Chinese. However, it has been reported that a number of Chinese firms, in response to this pressure, are beginning to hire locally. But I don't want to overstate this. There is a concern that on the continent, we do not have the right level of skills to also staff a number of these projects. In fact, I remember driving with a friend who's a banker in Kenya around ring roads which had been established in Nairobi, which if anyone has been to Nairobi, it will take you 3 hours on a good day to cover a 30-minute trip. And with these ring roads, what you have now are essentially cut down travel time to about 30 minutes. So when I was talking to the banker, I said, but how do we reconcile this with Chinese labor and investment in this region and with all the concerns that we have that I mentioned previously? And he says, Swithin, we had African contractors carrying out these contracts and were not delivering these roads in reasonable time. So there's a challenge of human capacity. The other issue I was discussing on Sunday with a former head of the IMF in Uganda, an Ethiopian gentleman, and I mentioned my discussion today, and he said, the Chinese bring ready-made infrastructure where we haven't had it. Well, this leads to a whole set of policy questions that should define the engagement between China and Africa that I'll describe later. Fierce competition to local traders, as I've mentioned, is also a concern, where you have Chinese retailers essentially borrowing from China Inc. or being granted, I don't know the arrangements, but I've heard as low as 1%, competing with small and medium business persons who are borrowing upwards of 19%. So there's just no way that competition can be fair. And local business communities are also concerned that they're not being supported by the national governments where these issues are being raised. However, it's also important to note that local consumers are attracted to the cheap, albeit inferior products that come from China. Labor practices were a centerpiece of the late Zambian president's dialogue with the Chinese. Indeed, he made that the centerpiece of his a campaign to be president. A Human Rights Watch reported in 2011 that the conditions in Chinese mines was the worst of all those that were foreign owned. However, there is an interesting dimension, as I mentioned at dinner last night, which is person to person, where we're beginning to see a social dynamic emerging with intermarriages between Chinese and African nationals, creating an unprecedented social dynamic. Many Chinese are not going back home after their assignments, and I see this in Nairobi, where they've basically, again, gone into small and medium enterprise. They're now, according to an African publication, The New African, there are now between 20,000 and 100,000 Chinese nationals in Zambia, according to census data. Many not going home. Some will settle in Zambia for good, bringing up Zambian-educated children with Zambian accents. This is an interesting development, since it's been the view of many in the region, and certainly out of the region, that the Chinese don't assimilate easily. The political dimension between China and Africa is really built on the following: political non-interference. Governance is untouched, so the way you behaved is not a centerpiece of the relationship, of the funding relationship. Unlike other Western donors, financial and other support is untied. In the MCC, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which is a US-based funding agency established under the Bush II era, the condition to participate to receive funding from the US is based on a whole host of criteria, whether at the threshold level or the compact level, which is a higher level of funding. Central to that relationship, funding relationship, is how you behave on a whole host of issues. There is no such conditionality in the China-Africa relationship. Indeed, as Ambassador Shin, who is a former US ambassador to Burkina Faso, observed, China's policy of non-interference in internal affairs of African countries and its fast approach to aid delivery make it more attractive than Western donors, whose aid often comes with demands to improve human rights and democracy. And then China also does play a de facto mentorship role at the UN. So many will argue, if asked the question, will the African tiger emerge at the current level of the relationship? Many will argue that the partnership is unequal, objectively speaking. And it's not because I'm speaking to an American or Western audience. I believe that the following steps would put our region on a much better footing: developing a sound strategy for dealings with China. There needs to be, in my view, a careful assessment of what the African interest is, and then develop, as a bloc, a collective bargaining position in that definition of that relationship. I think that priorities such as education, health, and other initiatives would help to move the region up the value chain if these were central to that discussion. And we see some evidence of South Africa, notwithstanding the challenges in South Africa that we all know, using this strategy as part of its bilateral relationship with China. There needs to be a policy ownership rooted in local experience. I was mentioning over dinner to colleagues last night my concern and those similarly situated, the invitation extended to African heads of state to visit China, and clearly no agenda that was had been taken to Beijing. Indeed, I was speaking to somebody on the Ugandan delegation upon their return from Beijing, and I said to her, you know, where are you coming from? I told her I was coming from Washington, asked her where she's coming from. She said she's coming from this conference, and she had this frown. And she said, we're cutting our own deals. The ministers were off cutting their own deals, but apart from one little country, which basically caucused at the end of each meeting to figure out the relations that would then follow from the meeting. There's need for strong governance and discipline that is essential to that relationship. I think the way that we govern, rooted in strong legal and judicial frameworks, should determine the policy of our relationship with the Chinese. Unless there's a strong leadership ethic rooted in these principles, we will lose the opportunity to emulate the Asian tigers. Now, some might argue not all the Asian tigers have had all these principles of democracy, but some will argue that the majority of those have been successful in promoting the economic development. Human dignity and integrity, my view and the view of many is the economies built on handouts from China will not build the integrity and self-worth necessary for development. The region is endowed with great wealth, as we all know, and has been shown by the Chinese interest. But there needs to be a focus on building human and institutional frameworks, which really don't need any donor support. I mean, just changing that would be a substantial dividend to raising GDP, just the goodwill that results from that kind of environment. And I think there are numerous fora for our leaders to engage with the Chinese. There's something called the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation and the African Union. These are all fora where there's regular interaction between the Chinese and the Africans. Why can't we push these principles in those fora? And this is one such meeting that took place in Beijing. My conclusion is that a true partnership between our region should be based on a clear identification of priorities and a quid pro quo on every aspect of the relationship. And the promotion of our infrastructure, our environment, should be really the bedrock of this dealing. Thank you.
Could you trace a relationship between the extent of Chinese involvement and the strength of a given African country's economy? I mean, are the most successful African countries the ones where China has invested the most?
I would actually say no. And probably as Chuck knows, and probably a number in this room, there's serious Chinese involvement in Sudan. Now, Sudan is by far
the least successful.
The least successful, especially southern Sudan, which recently came out of conflict. So they tend to be the trailblazers, going to places where nobody will go but where there are resources. But they are involved in South Africa in a large way, which is really the largest well, now bypassed by Nigeria recently, economy.
And it appears that Zambia is relatively popular for Chinese investment. Why is that? What do they see in Zambia?
Zambia has a lot of minerals. And Zambia is part of SADC, which is a group of very powerful countries, probably the strongest economic grouping in the region. And so through Zambia, it allows you to proliferate into places like Malawi, which are relatively weaker, Lesotho, and so on. Botswana, not so much, being a very strong country. I haven't heard of that much Chinese involvement there.
Wow. Well, I have two questions here about education. Are the Chinese investing in education in the sub-Saharan region? Has China helped raise education levels in Africa, particularly in needed skills?
One of my wishes, and I believe the wishes of many, would be if there was a lot of training in technical schools. What China has been very good at doing is building technical institutes, which many will argue, many leaders will argue, is really what is needed. But there's not so much training in teaching in those institutes or in the skills that would deliver the resources to maintain the infrastructure that is being built by them or by others.
I want to come back to that. Do the Chinese firms hire African workers, and to what extent for their African projects? Is it rare or is it common?
I would say it's rare, but because of pressure, it's growing. But there hasn't been a concerted effort to make this a cornerstone of our relationship with them.
So Zambia is kind of the exception in this, in that they actually objected to the paucity of African hiring.
Yeah, and indeed there was a threat by the late President Sata to expel the Chinese companies that weren't following this. You know, so it's isolated, but it needs to be, as I mentioned earlier, a common position in dealing with the Chinese.
I'm taking questions based on legibility here. Are the Russians still a factor in Africa?
The Russians are a factor, but they're not as predominant as the Chinese, even though a very high-profile project recently was awarded to a Chinese firm in Uganda, and that is to build a refinery in competition with a South Korean and I think American firm. But in the area of oil and gas, there is still some influence, and they tend to work together and sometimes on opposite sides.
China did not play a strong role in supporting development of the Asian tigers. Is Africa learning lessons from this? Isn't Africa allowing China too free a rein?
That is my principal concern. The terms of engagement have not been developed. And as I mentioned yesterday, China is not the Red Cross, nor is any other business person coming to the region. And so there needs to be a very conscious effort to ensure that there is a quid pro quo in this relationship.
Well, you say China's not the Red Cross, but then you mentioned that China, this is your term, picked up the tab for construction of the African Union building in Addis Ababa. What was in it for China? Why would they make that kind of, which does seem kind of Red Cross-y, that kind of a donation?
Well, I don't know the terms of that transaction, but what I do know is that there is quite a bit of, so in the case of Ethiopia, where the headquarters of the African Union are based, Chinese companies have been given thousands of acres to develop and take resources out of the country. Indeed, in most countries in the region, they're taking out of soil, just basic soil, all kinds of materials like timber is basically continuing unabated. Now, this is a concern.
Is China a net donor to Africa? Do their, quote, interest-free loans eventually get called back?
I have not heard of such a situation.
So they are a net donor, effectively, to Africa. The U.S. does, and China does not, impose human rights conditions on the investment they make. What could we say about these? Are these conditions being imposed by Western investors useful or not?
I would go a bit behind that and say we need to be imposing those conditions on ourselves and to basically determine how we govern. You don't really have to be told how you should govern because it's fairly self-evident. So the fact that China isn't saying it doesn't make it a better thing. Indeed, many will argue that it actually helps to entrench those administrations that actually want to suppress. So I think that is something that we need to, that needs to be dealt with internally.
I was concerned by your observation about the small traders that come in the marketplaces and compete at a terrific advantage to the Africans. The small traders, that's the backbone of your economy, I would think, of the African economy. How do these small participants get access to African markets? I mean, they couldn't walk in here and sell their goods because they would be wetbacks.
Exactly. Well, I think part of that has to do with a weak immigration policy. And then also the overwhelming need for foreign investment has resulted in some of the softer issues not being addressed, like labor, like the environment. And again, they're able to move into villages, into small trading communities, because, again, with the resources that they have, and please don't get me wrong, I mean, there has been backlash, but a few instances of backlash to the small business Chinese moving into the region or, you know, trading in items. But the fact that they have such low-cost items relative to those local producers or local tradespeople makes their products competitive.
But are they, aren't the governments inclined to expel these unfair competitors? I mean, why allow them in at all?
I think there needs to be, I mean, in the U.S. you have something called the Small Business Administration, and a number of incentives for smaller players in the economy. I think that speaks to what we need to begin to formulate in basically determining our relationships with Chinese and others. The protection of small business folks, that you don't see happening as much as it should.
China has been providing substantial assistance to African developments of extractive and infrastructure projects. But to what degree has China provided assistance in sustainable agricultural and potable water supplies?
I'm not aware of any. But I'm not an authority on this area, but as far as I know, I'm not aware of any.
There's one distinctly ugly side of the Chinese presence in Africa, and that is the poaching of animal parts, rhinos, elephants, rhino horns. Is there any pushback by the African governments against this?
Again, I have not heard of such policies. And again, that needs to be the cornerstone. All of these issues need to be part of the cornerstone of our relationship with the Chinese, the do's and the don'ts. And we're not seeing that to the degree that we should be. Labor, environment, poaching, all of these issues need to be addressed.
I'm having a little trouble interpreting this, but the questioner is asking about the effectiveness of Mohammed Ibrahim's foundation's anti-corruption program. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, Mo Ibrahim.
Mo Ibrahim.
Yes. Mo Ibrahim's foundation is basically a measure to improve governance by rewarding leaders who voluntarily step down with a monetary, it's a $5 million benefit and then a recurring contribution every year. The fact that that award has not been given for a number of years until very recently, a recipient who is the former president of Namibia, is a sign that it's not having its intended effect. In fact, there was one leader who mentioned that I did not come to power to collect awards like Ibrahim's. And this particular leader, very well known to be amassing great wealth. So the question is,
so that's why he came to power. Actually, we have a question on exactly that. How dependent are the powers that be on Chinese investment in order to stay in power? Is there a vested interest in the governors are the Chinese purchasing them essentially?
Well, I don't have any direct evidence of that. All I can say is we see the proof in the policies that we've been discussing here today, and so the proof is in the eating, so to speak. I think that maybe something that should be done is a forum that gives former leaders and governors the opportunity to find an existence after leading. We are seeing, as I said earlier during our dinner yesterday, that we are seeing a dividend. The region is not what it used to be back in the 70s. There is much more peace. There's much more democratic elections happening across the continent. The trouble spots are fewer. But there still needs to be an incentive, an organized incentive for former leaders to live a normal life.
This questioner observes that Uganda has been very successful in medical training. We know that because we see a lot of Ugandans in our hospitals and young doctors. Are you exporting too many trained medical professionals, and what can be done to keep them in Africa?
Well, in the area of HIV and AIDS, for example, Uganda has done exceptionally well in really bringing the problem to the fore in the mid-80s, was really one of the leaders. The area of medical training is excellent example of development, and indeed with Case Western Reserve University Medical School and other, which is based in Cleveland and my alma mater, and other universities, they're great medical programs. As to whether Uganda is exporting medical personnel, I don't know that I would say that. What I do know, though, is that Uganda is exporting a lot of medical and other personnel to the SADC region. This is a Southern African Development Community where they can earn better salaries and live, you know, a better life.
I want to turn attention now to some questions that have come in about the ILIA and its work in helping to establish the rule of law in African countries. First question is, would the ILI consider opening a branch office in Augusta, Maine to help us make laws that help Mainers? Well, that actually was not the African office. That we should address that to Chuck Verrill, who's the
exactly. As Chuck, you know, knows long before my time, and as I mentioned at dinner yesterday, the ILI was established at Georgetown Law School in the mid-50s. So that is really the root of our work. And we are an offshoot of that great establishment, and Chuck and colleagues. Chuck would be the best person to address that question.
We'll take that one offline, Chuck. Contrast the rule of law. How does the rule of law help combat corruption in Africa?
As I mentioned yesterday, there's no shortage of laws on the books in the region. What there is a shortage of is the will to implement the laws that are on the books. So I think it is a question of basically developing a zero tolerance for non-observance of these laws. And in some jurisdictions, we've seen success in developing a stable rule of law regime.
Give us an example. What's a country that the rule of law has been transformed by the kinds of things that ILIA is doing?
Transformed? Rwanda would be a good example.
Rwanda.
A country that went through the terrible genocide in 1994, and you go now and see the courts functioning, you can open a business in no time. There are challenges, as we all know, work in progress. Botswana, but some might argue that they've been so well endowed
exactly.
with resources that there's no really turning of a corner. Ghana, although there are challenges there. Uganda in some sectors, so for instance, in the area of local governance, local government, especially the managing of our city, Kampala, which was basically being run by thugs, and with a woman who is now a city administrator, the city is turned around. Everything is transparent. Trash collection is normal, lights are working, so it is possible. And it really has to do with the political will. Where there is a political will, there is a way.
What are you thinking about now? What country is on your mind where there is a budding political will and the resources of ILIA would best be worth investing?
I would say Rwanda. I'm not speaking for the Institute now, because colleagues may have other thoughts. Tanzania is a possible jurisdiction. They've had challenges with corruption, but they have been the recipients of the higher MCC aid because they passed so many of those tests. Lesotho, which is a small country surrounded by South Africa, which has also had some of its challenges, but really does really meet the criteria, if you will. Well, those are the ones I would mention.
What has to happen for the kinds of reforms that ILIA proposes to be invited to come forward in the first place? What will does there have to be in the part of the host nation in order for ILIA to be invited at all?
Well, I would answer that in two parts. One is, as my colleagues know, we tend to respond to requests for proposal. So we also have an economic sustainability mandate, to be able to exist. So we respond to requests for proposal and bid on projects, regardless of where they're coming from. Although we will not participate in projects where there are obviously questions of our lack of impartiality being challenged. But generally, the jurisdictions that invite us or where we have participated, such as Liberia, Rwanda, in Uganda, Lesotho, in the COMESA region, which is a 19-country grouping of Central and Southern Africa, that is really where there is a realization that for economic development to persist and for investors, whether local or international, to be attracted, there have to be certain conditions, such as functioning courts, such as the right types of infrastructure. So one of the things that we work on a lot these days is the area of PPPs, is public-private partnerships, where you have the public and the private coming together to build large infrastructure initiatives, such as highways, bridges, and so on. So it is in places where people realize that the dividends come from having the right structures in place. And that is really, after 18 years in the region, I'm happily seeing more of in sub-Saharan Africa.
You told us last night that one of the major sources of funds for the ILIA is Austria. Now, why is that?
Well, what I mentioned was that following the our entry into Uganda, we received a substantial grant from the Austrian government. I believe that they saw the value that the ILI in Washington had provided for so many decades in so many developing countries worldwide, and wanted to see that footprint in the region. And to have an indigenous solution focusing on international best practice being delivered in the region. So it was really an experiment. And since then, a number of others have provided support, such as the US government through MCC, USAID, the African Development Bank, the Norwegians, the Dutch, the Netherlands, and so on. So we had quite a number of partners.
Swithin, you've helped us to see the value of this as well, and we hope you have great success in continuing to put that footprint in sub-Saharan Africa. Swithin, delighted.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.